If you ever think that the numbers you hear about the economy feel very different to the experience you are living in that economy, you are certainly not alone. The idea of a hidden vibe session or K-shaped economy has become very mainstream as people try to reconcile the challenges they are facing with their own personal finances against the numbers that say everything is up and to the right. When a metric becomes a goal, it's no longer a useful metric. Elections are won or lost on unemployment numbers, so we massage the definition of unemployment to make numbers look good. Financial defaults can hurt the entire financial system, so banks hide away bad loans and pretend they don't exist. And CEOs can make life-changing amounts of money by getting their stock price to hit a certain value, so they do everything they can to hit that stock price. There has always been a motivation to interpret numbers favorably, but it seems like recently it's become far more common. So if we can't trust the numbers, are there any consequences to just ignoring reality?
Stock market up 53% in the past 2 years. It's very rare to have back-to-back years of 20% plus gains.
She worked in hospitality with the NBA.
I can't keep doing this.
As the rejections piled up, so too have the bills.
Since March, I've been living off of my 401k.
January has this great reputation of driving you up a wall, and I suspect we'll get a little bit of that.
Getting fired or laid off while still having to pay bills is a grown experience.
This market doesn't seem like it wants to go down.
Pessimism is profitable. Humans who paid more attention to potential threats were more likely to pass down their genes. And so now it's just human nature to fixate on bad news over good news. Media outlets know this, politicians know this, advertisers know this, and even YouTubers know this. There is a good reason why every influencer thumbnail ever is someone doing the shocked Pikachu face in front of a burning stock market graph. And that's because it works. As I mentioned earlier, I am guilty of this too. Commenters regularly say that they are back for their weekly dose of depression, which always gives the team and I a good laugh. But the truth is, we try and cover good news stories as well, and there have actually been a lot of them this year. The IRS rolling out effective tax policies to make sure wealthy asset owners are paying their fair share, rules limiting the shady practices of realtors, the crackdown on price-fixing algorithms, and the attempted banning of non-compete agreements. The only thing is, those videos just don't get as many views as the ones about less positive subjects. So even if you are subscribed, you probably just naturally see less good news than bad news. Although if you are not subscribed and you are feeling a little bit too optimistic about the new year, you know what to do. Alright, shameless plug over. This channel makes more than enough money to make sure everybody working here gets paid a good wage. And not to flex that YouTube money or anything, but there is even enough left over to cover my rent on a one-bedroom apartment in Los Angeles. So we are not going to stop making positive videos just because they don't do as well. But if you found yourself running a media organization with shareholders to answer to, you might see why it's easier to turn on the doom faucets. It can also be an effective marketing tactic. Most of the news you watch, including here on YouTube, is funded primarily by advertisers. Now you might think people who are worried about the economy and their financial future would make worse customers because they would be trying to save as much money as they can for that rainy day. But that's not always true. The Nobel Prize-winning economist Daniel Kahneman first popularized the idea of irrational loss aversion by conducting studies that challenged the idea that people always make logical decisions. He and other researchers ran tests like one where they gave participants $1,000 to play a game and then offered them a 50% chance of doubling that money or a 100% chance of just getting an extra $500. Most people chose to take the risk on doubling their money. However, when people were offered a 50% chance of losing their full $1,000 or a 100% chance of just losing $500, most chose to not risk it and just take the guaranteed $500. The point was that people tend to be risk-seeking when maximizing gains, but risk-averse when minimizing loss. So bad news is a really good way to sell things like medications, insurance, big safe cars, and political campaigns. You know, basically every ad you see if you are brave enough to turn on cable news. Now, to all of you watching from not America land, you are not immune to the effects of human nature. The only difference is, American news normally focuses almost exclusively on America, where news from your own country will include a healthier blend of domestic and foreign affairs. Now, the reasons for that are, a lot of Americans don't realize that there are other countries that aren't America, and foreign correspondence is expensive. If you are running a nice state-funded news outlet like the BBC or PBS, you can use those sweet taxpayer dollars to pay for people to report on foreign issues. Here in the United States of shareholder value, it's just not a good investment for profit-driven media. So Americans only ever hear about how bad things are in America, with maybe the occasional piece about where we are sending military equipment this week. Now, before this devolves into a rant about the state of modern journalism, this is far from the biggest problem. And while the media is definitely guilty of making us feel worried about the things that we shouldn't be, they are just as bad at ignoring the things that we should be. So it's time to learn how money works to find out how America got so rich and miserable. This week's video is sponsored by Monarch Money, which has basically become my personal money command center. Monarch is private and ad-free, syncs with over 13,000 banks, credit cards, and investment accounts, and puts everything in one clean dashboard. No ads, no data selling. You're the customer, not the product. In Monarch, I can see spending, net worth, debt payoff, and all of my recurring bills in one place. The budgeting setup is flexible too, with simple rules and categories that keep things organized without feeling rigid. And it even catches subscription creep automatically. I've been using it during my monthly budget check-ins, and having everything synced in one view has made things feel calmer and way less overwhelming. A quick glance at my dashboard gives me the full picture without jumping between apps. If you share money with a partner, Monarch has a shared view so you're both aligned and looking at the same goals and recurring bills. If you want to get your finances feeling more clear and under control, check out Monarch using the QR code on screen and use code HMWU50 for a discount. A lot of people are very angry about being told how good they have it when they are financially struggling. GDP per capita may be up, but that measures how much stuff the average person makes. It doesn't measure how much they were paid for making that stuff. Worker productivity is up, but median household incomes adjusted for inflation are still behind where they were in 2019. Put another way, the benefits of all our economic success are going mainly to benefit shareholders. Most major European countries also had stagnant household incomes. But it makes a little bit more sense for them because their GDP per capita over the last 10 years has also been stagnant. The people that have actually felt this the most in Europe are investors. America's S&P 500 index has more than tripled in the last 10 years in the same time that Europe's EU 50 has only gone up by 60%. For a majority of Americans though, that just doesn't really matter. Share ownership is highly concentrated amongst very wealthy people. And the vast majority of Americans get most of their money from exchanging their labor for a salary. For a lot of people, the stock market doing so well has actually been a bad thing, because they have been left further behind by asset owners who they might have to compete with for purchases, like a house. Someone whose portfolio has tripled in the last 10 years and is trying to buy their 10th investment property is going to find it much easier than the worker who is trying to save for a down payment on a stagnant income. We are also working much longer hours for the privilege. Germany is the largest comparable economy to America. And while we do, on average, have higher incomes, we also work more than 400 extra hours a year, or about 11 full working weeks. But once again, at least we aren't Canada. For all of this extra work and paper wealth, our actual quality of life as measured by the Human Development Index is now lower than Germany. They might be the sick man of Europe, but at least they get time off to rest. So unless you are absolutely committed to maximizing shareholder value, it's understandable to feel a little bit left behind.
How could you say that? How could you say that knowing that at 5:30 on a Thursday night, I need to be maximizing shareholder value?
America also kind of cheats a little bit. We are more productive than workers in Europe, but we haven't been pulling ahead of them quite as quickly as the charts like this would make you believe. Since the global financial crisis, the value of the euro, as well as other major currencies like the yen, the Canadian dollar, and the Australian dollar-y-do have all fallen against the American dollar, because people want to hold on to it as a financial reserve. This means that even though we have had higher inflation than places like Europe and Japan, our GDP per capita looks better, because it's been adjusted to a currency that has appreciated over time. But unless you are booking a trip to Europe or buying a whole lot of imported goods, this doesn't actually improve your life that much. My friend Yuri Shasfort, who runs the YouTube channel Money and Macro, made a great video on this a few months ago. He is clearly a godless, freedom-hating European, so his insights from their perspective are really interesting. Oh, and he is also a PhD economist, so he does a much better job of explaining the purchasing power parity problem than I did. Anyway, Europe being slightly more egalitarian than America is probably not exactly shocking to you, but at least rich Americans should be feeling optimistic, right? Well, sort of. Despite what the platitudes might tell you, money does indeed buy happiness. A survey of over 33,000 participants found that ultra-rich people were on average much happier than middle-income people, who were themselves much happier than people on a low income. But the happiest people of all were wealthy people from more equal countries like those in Scandinavia. Collecting and analyzing hard data on something as abstract as happiness is really hard. But a study published by Berkeley theorized that trust in fellow citizens and the government was the biggest contributor to that happiness. If a millionaire in Finland gets sick, they don't really have to worry about anything other than getting healthy again. Even a millionaire in America can spend a significant amount of that wealth on medical care. It's hard to enjoy your wealth when you are living in fear that it could be taken away from you at any moment. This extends through the ultra-wealthy as well. Ironically, billionaires are actually more common and more popular in Sweden than they are in America, so they have less concerns over punitive government actions. Now, while these big picture theories are all very interesting, here is what it actually means for you. This really matters because people who are pessimistic about the future are less likely to invest or acquire new skills or do anything that could actually help them get into a situation they could be more optimistic about. Collectively, you may have heard of the term vibe session, which has come to mean that even though economic figures look really good, people don't feel it, which lowers consumer confidence, which can cause a real recession. It can also stop people from actually going out and actually working to make things better. Making economic policy or business decisions without reliable data is like trying to fly a plane without reliable instruments. It's just not going to work. By their own admission, the Bureau of Labor Statistics and other government agencies in charge of collecting data have produced less reliable numbers over recent years, and it's only getting worse. A week before releasing the controversial jobs report, the Bureau made another press release talking about major compromises they were making in the collection of consumer prices. This data is used to make the Consumer Price Index, which is what they use to measure inflation. So, it's kind of important. To make matters worse, everybody from politicians to venture capitalists have started jumping in to provide solutions to a problem they really don't understand. But there are three big reasons why these compromises are being made in the first place, and three reasons why it's probably only going to get worse. The first reason is that markets are changing faster than ever, and traditional agencies are struggling to keep up with new economic realities. For example, the jobs report that is suddenly stirring up so much controversy is really two different surveys, the establishment survey and the household survey. The establishment survey is what was getting so much attention, and it works by asking thousands of businesses and government agencies how many people they have on their payroll for that month. Now, these surveyed businesses supposedly include small, medium, and large employers, but this already presents some challenges. Large employers are more likely to have dedicated human resource departments that can respond to these surveys as part of their full-time job, whereas small businesses on average aren't as timely if they bother doing it at all. The actual survey only takes about 20 minutes, and for a lot of larger companies, it's built in automatically to their payroll software. But for a small business owner already putting in long weeks, a 20-minute survey on payroll statistics often isn't the best use of their time. Even if they do respond to this completely optional survey, it's usually not until after the report has already been published. According to the Bureau themselves, they have been publishing recent reports with as little as 55% of the total eventual collected data, and it's only getting worse every year. To account for this difference, the BLS uses imputed data, which is just a nice way of saying guessing based on previous results. If they are still waiting on lots of small businesses to provide their data, they will look at what small businesses have said in the past compared to large businesses that have already provided their responses and use that to make their report. As any good finance bro will tell you, past performance is always the best predictor of future results. Now, hopefully you all know I am joking, but this system is normally good enough for most months. But the times where this strategy really suffers is during periods of rapid change. Small businesses feel the impacts of bad economic conditions faster and are normally the first to either let go of staff or go out of business completely. So, if reports are only using data from big businesses and then guesstimating the rest, then they won't notice these job losses until they have to go back and do revisions, like what is happening right now. Now, this has been the case since the survey was first conducted. Not to sound too alarmist, but these massive downward revisions were last consistently seen during the run-up to the global financial crisis. But what's changing now is that smaller businesses are just responding less overall, and there are a lot more of them. The rate of new business creation has increased massively since the pandemic. In the past, these were normally real businesses that had a good chance of creating real jobs for real people, and we are still imputing economic data based on that old assumption. When really, what most of these new businesses actually represent is people registering for their side hustle as an Uber driver in the gig economy. This not only goes a long way to explaining declining survey response rates because your average person driving Uber isn't going to fill out a BLS survey, but it also creates two bigger problems. The first is that it overestimates real job creation based on outdated assumptions. And the second is that even if this data was accurate, it doesn't capture a more pressing reality. We could create a million new jobs next month, and it won't do you much good if you are working three of them and still can't afford to make ends meet. And so far, all of this is just one report. there are dozens of agencies across America and the rest of the world that are failing to properly account for changing financial realities. There are a lot of government agencies dedicated to producing data on how the country and the economy is doing. The Bureau of Labor Statistics is the one cog in the machine that is making headlines at the moment, but other agencies like the Census Bureau, the Treasury, the Bureau of Economic Analysis, the International Trade Commission, the Department of Agriculture, as well as the data collecting branches of the IRS and the Fed all rely on each other to produce reliable numbers that they themselves put into their own calculations. For example, when the Bureau of Economic Analysis produces GDP data, about 70% of that is based on consumer data collected by the Census Bureau in their retail trade surveys. Interagency data sharing, as this is known, is not a result of laziness, but rather a feature of the system so that every department is overlooking every other department. But you can probably start to see the problems. Uncertainty in any part of the system creates uncertainty in the entire system, and that can be really useful for certain groups. The first are politicians who get to cast doubt on numbers that might make them look bad. But let's be honest, they never let numbers get in the way of a good spin anyway. The second group are large investment firms with access to their own proprietary data collection techniques. A report from a data firm published by Newswire estimated that investment management firms could spend as much as $15.4 billion this year on alternative data, which really just means anything not published publicly by government agencies or the media. That is 20 times the annual budget of a department like the Bureau of Labor Statistics. These firms are regularly employing tactics like using private satellite imagery or just running their own surveys where they will actually pay participants for more timely responses. The better their data is compared to the publicly available data released by government agencies, the more they can make on that data asymmetry. Now, you might think this sounds a little bit like insider trading, but it's not. Technically, the information they are collecting is out there for anybody to collect, and it's not their fault if the average goober on Robinhood doesn't have access to a fleet of spy satellites to collect it. This creates the second major problem with our economic data. It's more profitable to privatize the numbers. The BLS, for example, has 10% fewer staff and a 15% lower budget than it did in 2010 following the global financial crisis, after accounting for inflation. Now, that doesn't sound terrible, but the scope of its operation has also grown considerably in that time, making its job a lot harder overall. The fewer resources they have to actually go and collect primary data, the more they have to rely on guesstimations based on historical correlations. An article, ironically, published by Bloomberg last week reported that the agency would no longer be collecting consumer prices from certain rural regions due to budget constraints. According to the report, the volume of data they are effectively making up has more than tripled in the last 6 months alone. The reason this is so ironic is because Bloomberg is one of the biggest data retailers in the world. Every one of those black and orange screens filled with random spreadsheets and stock charts you see in videos on trading floors is a Bloomberg terminal. Each one of those computers costs about $30,000 a year in an ongoing subscription. And the reason that big investment firms pay that much is because it gives their staff access to information that just isn't available to regular people. Anyway, budget cuts can create a vicious but convenient cycle for these parties. These departments have their budgets cut, so they don't have as many resources to collect reliable reports. These unreliable reports with big adjustments are then used to show how pointless these departments are, so they get their budget cut even more. The average voter doesn't really understand what these people do. The average politician doesn't like having their work critiqued. And the average industry group would love it if they had a monopoly on good, reliable data. And that's the third major problem that's quickly getting much worse. Even if these numbers were absolutely flawless, are they even relevant anymore? There are lies, damn lies, and then there are statistics. It's a quote so old that nobody even knows who originally came up with it anymore, but it's remained relevant for hundreds of years. A survey that I ran on all of you while I was putting this video together found that an overwhelming majority did not think that current economic statistics were an accurate reflection of the real economy. Most people who are paying any attention to these numbers while still living in the real world inherently understand this. The idea that what is causing this disconnect is a secretive group of statisticians plotting away behind the scenes to make politicians look bad is frankly pretty dumb. But there is actually an element of truth in it. A report by Cambridge University found that as we have become more politically polarized and less likely to answer surveys, only the most partisan among us actually bother responding to be counted in the data. A business owner who supports a party currently in power is much less likely to respond to a survey with negative economic implications, and they are much more likely to respond if they have good news to share, like having hired new staff. It's less exciting than a shadowy conspiracy, but it is still a problem. Unfortunately, it also just distracts from the bigger problem. A lot of attention is being paid to the referees to see if they are keeping an accurate score. But nobody has stopped to ask why they are monitoring a jousting league. A lot of the data they collect is completely outdated in today's economic landscape. For example, the conditions to count as unemployed are pretty strict, and it doesn't account for a growing number of people who are underemployed or have simply given up on looking for a job altogether. Another absolutely horrible metric we have learned to think is really important is GDP per capita. A smaller channel by the name of Type Ashton did an amazing deep dive into the stupidity of this data point. So instead of ranting about it here, I will leave a link to it down below. The point is, long data series are good for assessing performance in comparison to the guy that came before, but they aren't always the best indication of how things are actually going right now. If this goes on for long enough, people will just stop caring. In fact, they kind of already have. 10 million working-age men have completely dropped out of the workforce, which is yet another example of a trend which is not captured with this data. Okay, so there are two general schools that people fall into when they see that nobody wants to work anymore. The first group are wealthy executives, business owners, or just people who have always worked incredibly hard who don't like that jobs are going unfilled. So they blame it on lazy young people who would rather sit around all day smoking cones and watching skibbity toilets. The second school of thought agrees that yes, people don't want to work. They don't want to work demeaning jobs where they won't get paid enough to support a decent quality of life. It's nice when two groups who are so different can agree on something. So really, the only thing left is to work out why people don't want to work. Now, in most cases, the jobs that nobody wants to work fall into one of three categories. The first are jobs that are just paying well below market rates given the experience or the location required. Businesses aren't going to be able to fill a full-stack senior development role in Silicon Valley for $50,000 a year plus equity in their questionable pre-seed startup, but there are still plenty that try. Even entry-level jobs that pay minimum wage in very high cost of living areas are going to be much harder to fill in a city where even finance bros are living in shared housing. Now, hot take alert. But just like there are no shortage of crappy businesses and managers that expect to pay workers nothing for world-class skills and experience, there are lots of workers who expect world-class pay with little or no marketable expertise. One of the most insightful pieces of data on this issue is this recent survey right here. It asked a selection of Americans what they considered to be the minimum salary they would need to be financially successful. Now, most of the responses to these numbers have been laughing at the Gen Zs just entering the workforce who think that almost $600,000 a year is a realistic salary goal. Because for most people, it just isn't. Unless you are in a few very specific career paths, there are basically no jobs that pay this money. And even then, you need an insane amount of luck to get those opportunities. Now, you can blame this on young people who don't really know how the world works yet, or social media that makes it look like every hustle bro is flying private, but it's all distracting from a more interesting data point. The average boomer thinks financial success is achieved with a salary of just under $100,000. According to the Bureau of Labor Statistics, this is still almost double the median national salary. But in most major cities where people can actually find jobs that pay this much, $100,000 certainly doesn't afford a lifestyle of financial success. There is simply a massive gap in expectations between the generations looking for their first jobs and the group responsible for giving out most of the jobs, so they both agree that nobody wants to work, just for different reasons. The second type of job that nobody wants to work are in workplaces that push their staff, demand unreasonable overtime, or have management that are needlessly abusive. This happens in a shocking amount of businesses across the country. And even if you are lucky enough to avoid a boss that thinks shouting is an effective motivation tool, you have probably worked some overtime out of fear of losing your job or being reprimanded. According to a 2023 workplace survey, the average full-time worker across the country studied is now putting in an average of 9.2 hours of unpaid overtime. These jobs often don't have much trouble finding people to start, but they do struggle with high staff turnover. The third are simply jobs that never actually existed. You probably all know about ghost jobs by now, but even if you really do want to work, there is a good chance that most of your applications are just going to build out a workforce database, not to actually be considered for employment. Now, whatever the specific reason, the results are the same. Less people end up working. But aside from settling some beef between entitled Zoomers and some out-of-touch boomers, this data all reveals something more concerning about work in the current economy. It's not that people don't want to work anymore. They simply can't afford to. There are also people who don't want to work because they think unless they are offered six figures in their first role out of high school, it's not worth their time, and they would be better off sitting at home working on their NFT dropshipping business. Both of these groups definitely exist in shockingly large numbers, but even though it's really fun to make fun of both sides, it distracts from the much more important reason why labor force participation is getting worse. Well, as you might have been able to guess, this trend is really being driven by specific age groups and specific locations. If you look at labor force participation and exclude the youngest generation of workers and the oldest generation of workers, it's actually approaching all-time highs, which really makes sense when you think about it. It's common for both men and women to work full-time these days, and for most households, it's simply a financial necessity. So yeah, even if people don't want to work anymore, they kind of are stuck doing it anyway. The reason labor force participation has fallen off in general, though, is because the average is being dragged down by a lot of young workers and old workers. The old workers are the easiest to explain. As people started living longer, retirement ages were pushed back, and more of the population began working in non-physical jobs. As a result, a larger share of the population over 55 remained in the workforce. This has started to reverse, though, as self-funded retirement systems and general asset prices have allowed a lot of over 55s to step back from the labor force, especially after COVID, as a lot of people received severance packages and decided that an early retirement was better than going back to the office. Labor force participation from young people just entering the workforce either out of high school or college is also pulling down the average, just for different reasons. More people than ever are getting a college degree, which means they are starting to work later, and fewer people are working part-time jobs while they study because for many, it's simply not worth it given how much debt they are going to be in when they graduate anyway. This might not also be a shock to you, but it's getting really damn hard to find a job out of college. A few months ago, a post from a professor at Berkeley made the rounds after it spoke about his top students from a top college struggling to find work in technology, an industry that was hiring highly intelligent graduates like this as fast as they could make them just 24 months ago. Previously, a Berkeley CS graduate, even if not a top student, would receive multiple appealing job offers in terms of work type, location, salary, and employer. However, outstanding students, like those with a 4.0 in-major GPA, are now contacting me worried because they have zero offers. I suspect this trend is irreversible and likely part of the broader trend impacting almost every employment sector. It's pretty grim stuff coming out of one of the best schools in the country. It might not be the most logical thing to do, but a common reaction from people who can't land a job with a degree they got to make them more employable is to just go get another degree. The rate of master's and PhD recipients has grown even faster than people getting an undergraduate degree, because that's now normal to stand out in a highly competitive job market. And to be honest, it's a nice way for people to avoid the reality of the job market for another few years. Spending another 2 to 8 years at college to get advanced degrees means people aren't in the labor force, which pulls down the average to look worse than it really is. So those are the ages that are perpetuating this dumb myth. But this trend is also highly dependent on location. And to see that, you need to go to the place where apparently the absolute least amount of people want to work. Yes, the Rust Belt state has the lowest labor force participation in the country, but also some of the most unusual statistical anomalies. The state is quite poor after its major industries like coal mining and manufacturing were either outsourced or simply fell out of widespread use. This means that a lot of areas have effectively been left behind with no major employment opportunities, meaning that labor force participation is much lower than the national average. But strangely, in some areas, the participation rate is much higher than what would be expected. A recent study conducted by economists from Hamline University, Cornell, and Virginia Tech found that depending on the county, labor force participation in West Virginia ranges from 42% to 77%, a gap between regions of 35%. While the average across the US states is just 17%, less than half of West Virginia. It's not unusual that cities and working towns will have higher labor force participation than other areas, because people often specifically move to these locations just to get work. But this variance was startling and uncovered a bigger national trend. The people in areas that still had work can't afford not to work. And the people in areas with no work couldn't afford to move to areas with work since it could mean giving up family support networks or simply paying for the cost to relocate housing. A lot of people who had the financial means have already moved out of the state, only making this problem worse, as they take business opportunities and money away with them. It's a dense read because it's an academic paper. It's for nerds. But if you ever feel compelled to say that nobody wants to work anymore, I definitely suggest you have a look at it. The report itself also looks at welfare issues specific to West Virginia. But just because the state is experiencing this problem the worst doesn't mean that it's in any way just something hurting them. The trend of a few concentrated cities doing extremely well while everywhere else stagnates can make nationwide figures look good. but it also means people who want to work have an option of trying their luck for one of the few jobs left in areas with fewer opportunities, or living in an extremely expensive city to compete with everybody else fighting over a spot in the few places left where people can reliably get ahead. Finance and tech have become one of the last escape ropes for people to make a deal with the devil to get out of these areas with little to no opportunities. And I am going to be writing an article about how even that career path is becoming impossible in my completely free email newsletter. So sign up if you are interested in reading that and other articles that will never be made into videos here. Now, obviously, a lot of this could be handled by companies just allowing remote work, so go and watch my recent video on why companies absolutely will not let that happen for anybody except their CEOs. Small business is the backbone of our economy, or at least that's the story. Entrepreneurs taking a chance on themselves to start a business have provided employment to millions of people, created innovative products and services that you enjoy every day, and in return, they can achieve levels of financial success that would be impossible with almost any regular old day job. You would be silly not to give it a go at least once in your life, right? Well, that message has been heard loud and clear by millions of people, because if you look at the numbers, it would seem we are living through a golden age of new entrepreneurs. There are now twice as many new business applications being processed every month than there were before the pandemic. Politicians on both sides of the aisle have been quick to take credit for this trend as the personification of the American dream. Unfortunately, this record-setting business creation has made a lot of people very angry, because those new businesses are being started by poor people. So instead of being an indication of a thriving business environment, it's instead a sign of everything wrong with our economy, if you believe the numbers. So new businesses being formed is normally a really good sign that the economy is doing well. People normally only start a new business when they feel confident about their future and the future of the market they want to operate in. If you thought a recession was all but guaranteed and you weren't sure how you were going to pay your bills next month, you probably wouldn't be starting a business. Launch of new business creation is also a sign that people have achieved a certain level of financial security. Starting a new business often means making some significant upfront investments into renting some commercial space, buying equipment, purchasing inventory, and for a lot of businesses, hiring some staff. Most new business owners should also expect to go for some time without taking any income while their business builds up sustainable cash flows. This means if lots of people are starting businesses, lots of people are in a comfortable enough financial position to bear these costs. Lots of new businesses is also more than a sign that things are going well. They actually make things go well. New businesses create employment for people who just want a job, and they improve productivity in a few ways. Business owners, especially new business owners on average, will put in more time and effort working for themselves than they would in a regular day job. This means they're making more output than they would be if they were just working a 9-to-5. New businesses can also become successful businesses that bring valuable products or services to market. If you start a business-to-business company that develops a new type of software that streamlines AI-generated LinkedIn appreciation posts, then you could save millions of wasted man-hours across the country, which means workers could actually do something better and more productive with their time. Likewise, if you start a business selling a consumer product, it could add competition to the market for similar products, or if you develop a new product altogether, it could make people happier, healthier, smarter, or just keep them entertained. Of course, most new businesses fail. But for society at large, the few that succeed are usually a good thing. So then why is this record level of business creation in America not exactly great news? Well, there are actually three reasons. The first is simply why these businesses are being started. A 2023 paper by Ryan Decker of the Federal Reserve Board and John Haltewanger of the University of Maryland found some interesting patterns with these new businesses. The first was that these new businesses were largely being formed in states and counties with lower average incomes. Now, most counties saw an increase overall, but the outskirts of cities, particularly hard-hit states, outpaced the rest by a significant margin. The authors of this paper suggested that a lot of this business formation was just existing businesses closing in city centers that didn't see much foot traffic and reopening in suburbs where the rent is lower and they can cater to a market of people working remotely. This wouldn't actually really increase business activity because it's just moving it around from one place to another. But closed businesses can stay registered for a long time after they physically shut down. Now, this move to the burbs might not actually be doing any good, but it's not doing any harm either. Unfortunately, it doesn't account for the entirety of this trend. And a lot of the other people starting a new business aren't doing it to follow their dreams. They are doing it because they have no other option. And it's probably making things much worse than we realize. So actually figuring out how our economy is going is something that our governments really struggle with. Collecting data on hundreds of millions of people, millions of businesses, and billions of transactions is actually really hard. So they often make some calculated guesses based on historic patterns. As impractical as it would be for the Bureau of Labor Statistics to scrape every job posting off Indeed and look through every classified section to find new jobs being created, it wouldn't even be that accurate. The rise of ghost job listings means that there are almost twice as many job postings as there were 5 years ago. But as anybody who has tried to get a job in the last 24 months will tell you, businesses aren't exactly in a rush to hire. That's a problem, because government agencies use job creation data to make very important budget and interest rate decisions, so we really shouldn't be making shit up. One of the other historical assumptions has been more business creation equals more job creation. Businesses need employees, so this makes sense. Except the data has actually started saying the opposite. In the report on the rise in new business applications, Decker and Haltewinger found that counties with a higher rate of business creation were actually correlated with a higher rate of job destruction. This data really just confirmed what a lot of people already suspected. People weren't starting businesses to take advantage of some amazing opportunity. They were starting them because they had no other choice. According to a broad market survey, 36% of the American workforce is now engaged in the gig economy. Some of these people are doing this in conjunction with their regular day job as a way to earn extra money. But whatever the exact details, that is still a significant increase from just 5 years ago. Gig workers are encouraged to register a business and keep track of their revenue and expenses just like any other business. But unlike other business, none of these people are going to be hiring employees or investing a lot of money into the broader economy. In the past, people starting a new business usually had a bit of experience in their field and a bit of cash in their pocket to get their business set up. At the very least, they had some investors that were willing to trust them with upfront capital to get their idea off the ground. Most of these new gig economy businesses today are started by people without enough experience to land a job and without any cash at all. Now, it's not all bad. For a lot of people, being able to sign up instantly to perform work in the gig economy instead of going through the outdated hurdles of job interviews is a big reason why these platforms have become so popular. But these jobs also shouldn't be sugarcoated. They are insecure, don't pay well, and are quite dangerous. This technology is truly unprecedented, and in the short term it has existed, it's already reshaped what we think of as work. It's really up to you if it's been for better or worse, though. So you might think this is just another example of a slow government struggling to keep up with changes in technology that have redefined the labor force. But there are two reasons why government agencies have tried really hard to intentionally ignore this trend. The first reason is that headlines about job creation and business development are great for re-election. Nobody wants to be in charge when the data collectors change their methodology and reveal that millions of jobs we thought exist actually don't. The second reason is that it makes it look like big programs are actually working. Late last year, the Small Business Administration made a press release bragging about the success of a business loan program made to minorities. In it, they highlighted how previously underrepresented groups had been starting a record number of businesses. Now, before a whole big thing starts in the comments, yes, these loans probably should have been made based on socioeconomic need, but statistically, they show the same thing anyway. The Small Business Administration thought they had successfully empowered a new group of business owners. What they had actually done was just record these groups registering for Uber Eats. Even highly skilled workers with a lot of experience have not been immune from this trend either. The number of people working as independent contractors jumped significantly as businesses moved away from full-time hires and the worker protections that came with it. Typically, independent contractors should have the freedom to work when and where they want as long as they deliver the agreed-upon product or service within the agreed-upon time frame. But a lot of businesses have not so subtly mandated that their contractors be in office just like any normal employee, just without the security or benefits. A study by the National Employment Law Project found that a lot of these independent contractors were forced to sign non-compete agreements as part of their contract. This meant they had all the independence of an employee combined with all the safety of someone in business for themselves. Now, for certain people, especially those at the top of their field, being an independent contractor is a great opportunity to provide services to multiple different companies and charge a much higher hourly rate than 9-to-5 employees ever could. These kinds of private contractors didn't suddenly become twice as common, though. Most of this growth is simply explained by people working full-time jobs with contractor conditions. It also means that job opportunities aren't as plentiful as the numbers would suggest, because even if lots of new jobs have actually been created, they are likely being worked by someone who already had a job and just needed a second or third source of income to keep up with living expenses. Now, I know for a lot of you watching, you already know this, but ignoring this issue will probably end up making it worse. These charts aren't just here for me to make depressing videos every week. They should inform policy. If we can't even acknowledge a problem, it makes it much harder to fix. Now, if we want to encourage genuine business activity, that's great, and there's a lot we can do. Actually banning non-competes, making it easier for business owners to save for retirement, and making access for healthcare easier for people who don't get it through their employers. But these things are hard. There is one other group that would really like everybody to keep on looking the other way, and those are the platform businesses that have made this all possible. Every time green line does not go up, we are told some company or the market has lost, destroyed, or wiped out however many billions of dollars. But alright then, where does that money actually go? It might not surprise you to learn that headlines like this are written more for shock and awe than genuine insight, but the simple truth is that the money doesn't actually go anywhere, because it never existed in the first place. Sort of. If you can look beyond the flashy headlines like this and actually understand what they are trying to say, you are going to be much better equipped to make sensible financial decisions when everybody else is busy losing their minds and, if they are lucky enough, maybe even their retirement savings too. This basic understanding has probably actually never been more important than it is right now, because the stock market is breaking new records every single week. Nobody knows if or when the party will stop, but what we do know is that, in this particular case, the money doesn't actually have anywhere else to go.
$5 trillion in value had been wiped from the markets in just 3 weeks.
Gold prices hit a record high on Tuesday.
The dream of owning the house with the white picket fence increasingly giving way to white picket renters.
Could buy a house tomorrow if the price was right, if the interest rates were where they needed to be.
Help for the economy from Washington remains nowhere in sight.
So there are really three different levels of technical explanation for what happens to money during a crash. The good enough for most people level, the armchair market analyst level, and then the level that considers debt, consumption, and all the different asset markets that are getting kind of weird at the moment. Now, most people don't even get level 1 right, but I promise none of this is as complicated as the financial bros would like you to think. And actually seeing how these markets work is the only way to understand how messed up they really are at the moment. But alright, most of the time when headlines are talking about billions of dollars being destroyed or whatever, what they are really saying is that the market capitalization of a company or group of companies has been repriced. This is just calculated using the number of outstanding shares multiplied by the price the last share was traded at. So for example, Nvidia currently has about 24 billion outstanding shares, and right now those shares are trading at a price of about $170, which gives the company a market cap of $4.1 trillion. If for some reason tomorrow people decided to start trading Nvidia shares at $85, then it would have the market cap of the company and you would inevitably see headlines about Nvidia losing $2 trillion. But they didn't really lose $2 trillion. They were just revalued using this very crude calculation. Now, technically, this could actually help Nvidia's ongoing business operations. Since the AI boom, the company has been doing a lot of share buybacks, where they will use their profits to buy company stock off existing shareholders to take it out of circulation. They are only supposed to do this when management thinks the company is undervalued. So if their stock halves in price, they will get twice as many shares for the same money, which should be a good thing, right? Well, this is assuming, of course, that they aren't just doing stock buybacks to drive up an already hyped up stock. Part of what is making the current stock market so strange at the moment is that by far the biggest net purchaser of shares in these companies are these companies. According to the Fed's Z1 financial accounts, households made net purchases of about $100 billion of stock in 2024. This was dwarfed by listed corporations that did over $625 billion worth of net buying, meaning that companies were buying six times more of their own stock than actual stockholders were. Now, that doesn't seem great, but it's actually worse than it sounds. The whole point of a stock market is that it's supposed to be a place where companies can go and sell their shares to raise money to fund business operations. This net sales figure also includes the company subtracting from this net number by conducting IPOs. The total gross value of stock buybacks was over $1 trillion within 2024 alone. It just so happens that companies also raised about $375 billion in the same year. Now, this has helped to increase market capitalization by driving up share prices, but that's not even the biggest problem. It will actually get more important later on as we go into how asset markets are supposed to function. But for now, for level 1, a market crash is just a readjustment in market capitalization. Unless a company is planning to sell its own stock to raise money to fund future projects, its day-to-day market capitalization shouldn't impact its performance. Market capitalization is kind of like GDP. It's a number that we use a lot because it's sort of easy to calculate, and it's good enough as a rough indication of if things are going in the right direction or not. Now, a lot of people, when they learn this, take it to mean that market cap is irrelevant. A $10 banana is no better than a banana that's on clearance for $5. And while that's true, a sudden price drop on anything can be an indication that there is something rotting away beneath the surface. So, for the next level of understanding, you need to do what the journalists writing the headlines aren't willing to do, and actually follow the money. Now, I know I just said that if a stock halves in value, that doesn't necessarily mean that any money has gone anywhere. But in highly liquid markets, such a scenario can only really happen one way. The NASDAQ doesn't get to slap a 50% off clearance label on Nvidia stock like Walmart does on questionable milk. The way the price moves in these kinds of markets is that if there are more sellers than buyers, the price falls, and if there are more buyers than sellers, the price rises. When people are panic selling stocks, they are still getting money in exchange for their stocks. It may not be as much as they wanted, but what they then do with that money is where things get interesting. Let's say you had some spare money. Yeah, I know, but just pretend with me for a second. With your pile of cash, you have some options. You can invest into the stock market, real estate, bonds, gold, alternatives like cryptocurrency, or you could just hold on to your cash. Alternatively, if you just want to enjoy your life right now, you could spend that money on goods and services like a new car, a bigger house to live in, or a nice vacation. All of these activities that improve your quality of life are generally classified as consumption. Depending on where you and everybody else who has spare money puts their cash, it will increase the value of these markets. So if everybody buys gold, its price will increase as demand increases on an asset with limited supply. Now, stocks, bonds, and real estate are kind of unique because they generate their own cash flow to give money back to you. Stocks do this through dividends, bonds through interest, and real estate through rent. Those cash flows come from other people deciding to put their money into the consumption pile, which becomes revenue for these three asset classes. But all of these other assets really only make returns by having more people buy in at a progressively higher price. When the stock market crashes, what is really happening is everybody trying to grab their cash out of that particular asset market. They do this either because they think the market won't generate as much cash flow in the future, or more often, just to get their cash out before everybody else lowers their price by taking their cash out. Now, if you were lucky enough to get your cash back before everybody else, you have a choice. During a lot of market crashes, people just want to hold on to their cash because they are afraid they will lose their jobs and nothing else is generating cash flow. But eventually, you will need to put your money somewhere. And that predicament is what is creating such a big problem right now. Sure, maybe you think that the stock market might be an AI-fueled bubble, but if you sell your positions, where exactly should you put your money? Gold is at all-time highs. Real estate is risky with today's interest rates. Cryptocurrency is highly correlated with the stock market. Goods and services are more expensive than ever, and people are even starting to question the long-term safety of the bond market. People are quickly running out of safe platforms to stand on, which has got a few people saying that maybe these markets aren't actually broken. Maybe it's the money that's broken. The way that money flows in and out of these markets can have a big impact on the way that you live your life, even if you don't actually have that much in any one of these respective piles. Increasing housing prices have become a defining financial problem of young generations as people can't afford a place to start their own lives or their own families. House prices have outpaced inflation by a lot, which I know is not exactly shocking to most of you, especially if you have watched any of the dozens of videos we have made about the structural problems and broken incentives in the housing market. But the key here is that when we measure price increases relative to inflation, we are only measuring relative to the consumption pile here with the consumer price index. The problem with this is that it doesn't reflect the changing gaps between these other money piles. Real estate, for example, has grown faster than consumer prices, but relative to fixed assets like gold, it's actually gone backwards. An article published by Jonathan Hobbs, a chartered financial analyst, compiled this data to show that if you were paying for the average American house today in gold, you would be spending about half as much as you would have been back in 1991, and roughly a quarter of what you would have been paying in the early 2000s. Now, the article itself used this data to build a case for just buying gold. But the reality is basically any assets would have had the same effect. If you were paying in S&P 500 indexes, the relative fall in house prices would have been even greater. So there are two lessons from this. One is that investing is important. I hope you already knew that. But the deeper lesson here is that it's become much easier for people with lots of money in these piles to buy basically anything they want from these piles. There is only so much money that people can spend on consumption, so wealthy people naturally throw the rest into one of these. As they have grown, they have provided more money to people who own them, and since most of them were already maxing out what they could throw into consumption, they put even more back into these piles, creating a feedback loop of wealth generation. A basic look at the historic numbers makes this pretty clear. Market returns over the past 60 years have averaged just over 10%, and inflation has averaged just over 4%. If you include taxes, this generally means if you can consume less than 4% of your invested assets annually, you can live forever without touching your principal. This basic arithmetic is the foundation of things like the financial independence retire early movement. But for extremely wealthy people who can easily afford to live on less than 4% of their net worth, they can compound wealth faster than they can spend it. Now compare this to most people who earn their income by selling their time. Most wage increases are indexed to consumer prices, if you are lucky, which has been the slowest growing one of these piles. This has made it harder and harder for the wages to compete when both groups want to put their money into the same area. A lot of what the wealthy are buying is different from what working people are buying. But there are some areas where these cross over. Real estate is just the most obvious and socially destabilizing example of that. The reason this is happening now is that the growth in these asset piles has become unprecedented. We have been paying a lot of attention to what the money printer has done to consumer prices, but these other money piles have soaked up much of the excess cash and it has put non-asset owners further behind. Now, the point of this is not that inequality has become worse, you already knew that, but a new problem coming from that is how these increasingly consolidated markets are behaving. According to the Fed, participation in the stock market is approaching all-time highs, which sounds like a good thing. But this has mainly been driven by lots of people investing very small amounts of money through platforms with low fees and low barriers to entry, like Robinhood. The real money in these asset markets is more consolidated than it has ever been, with the top 10% of households owning 93% of all equities the last time this data was collected at the end of 2024. In a market panic, the reason why people sell their assets is because they want to make sure they have enough cash on hand to cover their most basic consumption needs if they lose their source of income, which for most people is their job. Unfortunately, job losses and market downturns often go hand in hand. However, as these assets have become more consolidated amongst people who can easily cover their living expenses several times over, there have consistently been more people with lots of spare cash to buy in versus the people that need to sell out to cover themselves in a hard time. Put another way, if unemployment was to hypothetically spike tomorrow for any particular reason, most of the people losing their jobs would not have a meaningful pile of assets to sell to cover themselves while they were looking for a new job. And it's not like we would miss the consumers either. A majority of the consumer spending in the economy now comes from the top 10% of households, and corporate profits are primarily driven by selling stuff to other corporations. Sounds pretty bad, right? Well, it gets worse. Remember those record-setting stock buybacks from earlier? Well, they have outnumbered net household share purchases 6-1, adding even more people to the side piling money in. If you add this to the rise of index funds that mindlessly buy and hold a broad selection of shares, it's easy to see how lopsided the market has become. Now, this does not mean that markets can't fall, but what it does mean is that they can stretch far further and stay irrational far longer than they could ever before, and while they do, they are throwing off money like never before for people to buy up every other asset market. Sounds pretty bad, right? Well, it gets worse. A huge amount of this money recently has been tied up in chasing returns from AI. These companies have spent trillions of dollars on this project, so far. But watch this video next to find out how it's costing all of us just as much, if not more, and don't forget to like and subscribe to keep on learning how money works.